Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, ready to take you on another journey deep into the criminal mind. In this episode, we're exploring a sad yet fascinating tale that transpired February 7th, 2009. On that day, a 41-year-old wife, mother, and schoolteacher named Dar Foley was murdered in her Coldwater, Michigan farmhouse, the victim of a vicious cold-blooded assailant who delivered a shotgun blast to her face while she was home alone taking a shower, and then ransacked the house in what initially seemed to be a robbery. Dar was in the process of getting ready to attend a birthday party at another location for her 10-year-old son, Heath, who drove to the event with his father, aka Dar's husband, Tom Foley, in addition to Heath's friend Skyler. The two boys and Tom left the home first in Tom's truck, with Dar planning to follow soon after. But she never arrived. Soon enough, Tom became worried and drove home to see if there was a problem. That's when he found his wife in a pool of blood inside the shower. It was a husband's worst nightmare. Or was it? What seemed like a robbery at first glance slowly became a situation in which investigators believed Tom Foley wasn't telling the truth about the events that occurred that day. What seemed like a robbery at first glance slowly became a situation in which investigators believed Tom Foley wasn't telling the truth about the events that occurred that day, and a further look into the couple's marriage insinuated a rift. Before long, a shocked Tom Foley was arrested for Dar's murder, and a trial later that year would see him convicted and sent to prison, causing him to lose custody of his son in the process. It was a circumstance in which everybody in the family lost everything they had and had ever loved. On appeal, however, and due to new evidence arising in the case, Tom was retried. This time, the jury found him innocent. In the end, while the prosecutor, in addition to Dar's family, believed Tom was the killer and the punishment at his first trial was warranted, Tom Foley became a free man. He picked up the pieces of his life and continued raising his son Heath. Yet, regardless of his innocence or guilt, Dar's killer is still free. There is no justice. So let's go back to the beginning of this story, way back after high school when the couple met and started dating. Tom's claim to fame in high school was that of a star basketball player, one who hit the game-winning shot to give his team a regional championship. It wasn't just a big moment for him, but the entire town. He claims that, for a long time, people would continue to approach him or just see him out somewhere and say something like, "Hey Tom, remember when you hit that shot?" Of course, he did remember, and it still brought a smile to his face years later. Unfortunately, that's pretty much where the glory ended for Tom Foley. You might be expecting one of those sad stories where the person with all sorts of talent made tons of bad decisions and ruined his life with drugs or something similar after failing to make it big like he hoped. That's not what happened with Tom. Not at all. He just didn't do much in his adult life. He wasn't too ambitious. Now, I'm sure in one form or another on this podcast, each of you has heard me refer to the concept of evolution swarming. Of course, when I normally discuss that, it's in the context of a criminal pulling a snatch and grab on the jewelry case of society in the form of stealing resources, whether we're literally talking about money or even committing murder. A crime is committed and the perpetrator must remain undetected to avoid getting caught, while society must band together to catch that person. It's a game of cat and mouse with light sources. If you remain undetected, you can keep committing crimes, but if you get caught, your inclination to redirect light for personal gain will be negated in jail. That's what we normally talk about on this show. So, someone kills somebody and runs off, but a neighbor heard a scream and comes running. He finds a dead body and calls the police. The police investigate and also notify the public a killer is on the loose. The public sees the perpetrator and identifies him, etc. The process continues until the bad guy, so to speak, has been detained in a manner that prevents him from indulging further antisocial behavior that's destructive to the social contract of civility that's required in order to maintain peace in society. In this case, we'll discuss that end of the spectrum in relation to evolution swarming, but what I really want to address right now is the polar opposite end. And that, my friends, equates to attention, or popularity, or even ascension, rather than criminality. It's the type of detection an individual welcomes, or even adores at times as well. In fact, sometimes we're obsessed with getting attention. We'll do anything for it. In some capacity or another, most of us desire to be the best at something, to be admired for things like talent, good looks, overcoming adversity, or anything similar. These are traits and actions that can elevate our evolutionary worth, even just in terms of perception. The entire portfolio of social media these days is predicated on it. If you write a viral tweet, whether it's your 578th attempt at writing a funny joke this year, or a GoFundMe for your aging dog with 8 legs, the feedback, in the form of likes, retweets, favorites, shares, comments, and more, equate to more attention. Your brain is designed to savor that feeling because we're all intended to compete for attention in the same way we compete for jobs in the employment marketplace. It's all a competition. But attention is fleeting. There are many factors that can cause it to come and go. So, the idea is to find a way to stay relevant. If you do, you retain access to resources related to the shine you're afforded through all that attention. Yet, if evolution swarms to you in a positive way, increasing your social value in the process, and you don't maintain it, or even seek to elevate it, the benefits of the resources you acquired will start to dwindle. While you were once the sun, if you don't maintain that status with followers, so to speak, the shine you provide basically goes from a flaming star to a light bulb. One of the most stereotypical instances of this occurrence takes place in athletics, and the reason is that athletes not only age out of their abilities fairly early in life, but when they are active, the level of talent creates a virtual pyramid of exclusivity in the sense that, at the bottom, when everybody's a little kid, everyone can participate. But as you rise through high school, into college, and then to the pro ranks, only those able to capture the most shine will participate. You don't have to make the basketball team when you're 7 or 8 years old. They just let you play. It's even common for sports leagues involving young children to have rules that everybody has a chance to get to play. They put teamwork and inclusion ahead of everything else because kids truly need to learn those things. But as you rise in the ranks, the question goes from, are you willing, to, are you able? By the time you reach the level of a varsity high school sport, exclusion is a regular practice. Some people don't make the team. They're just not talented enough. And of the people who do, some of them don't play. And of the ones who play, a few of them are more effective than the rest. At the top of that pyramid, where you have the most talented and effective participant, also lies the greatest extent of the shine. If you're the star quarterback on the football team, people want to shower you with attention and be near you. If you just won $500 million in the lottery, same goes. In the same way the sun offers light, proximity to winners does it too. Someone who outperforms everyone else, whether by skill or luck, undergoes a deification process with other people. The person at the top of the pyramid represents God, or perhaps more appropriately, it depicts the concept of God. In your life, undoubtedly you have indulged in, or even just fantasized about, some type of pursuit that could potentially put you at the top of a pyramid. For some people, it's the boss's job with the corner office at work. For others, it might be the winning rhubarb pie at next summer's festival, or even writing a book that wins awards. In some respect, we all have dreams of being the top rung on the ladder. But what I can say for sure is that nobody dreams of falling to the ground from it. And that's what happened to Tom Foley. He didn't maintain his shine due to a refusal to adapt and change after his basketball glory was over. And it cost him. So let's discuss the specific visual process of how Tom Foley earned his shine and then examine the manner in which he lost it to understand his motivations here. It's not something we actually need to watch. We've all seen this scenario a million times, and many of us have envisioned ourselves being this person as well. In the final moments of the regional high school championship I mentioned, in which Tom Foley becomes a local legend for hitting the game-winning shot, we literally get to see Evolution swarm. So, it's the final seconds of the game, and one of the players on Tom's team is dribbling the ball down the court. He gets past the three-point line and realizes he's being defended pretty well, so he dishes the ball out to the right wing, where Tom is out near the baseline. Tom catches the ball, shoots, and nails the shot to win the game. His team goes wild, while the other team is stunned. Cheering fans empty the stands lining the gym and storm the court below to join the team. It's this giant swarm of people, and they all want to get as close as possible to that shine the team has just created through becoming the top block on the pyramid. They have excluded everyone else along the way in this deification process. Everybody at the school is suddenly a winner, and the guys on the team even more so, but the deity here, the god, is Tom Foley. So, on the Coldwater Cardinals high school basketball team, at this time, there's no better person to be than Tom Foley. Everybody wants to be near him. That instantaneous evolutionary ascension causes society to swarm the court and be near the sun, while showering the king with praise. I believe he was carried off the court on someone's shoulders, seated high above everyone else, and worshipped, essentially. Now, that was the best you could do back then in the mid-1980s. Today, you and your friends can waste 3 years of your lives trying to hit a shot that starts off a 25th floor skyscraper balcony, bounces off a pedestrian's head, rolls over a car, traverses a four-lane highway, and finally lands on top of a flagpole before going in the basket, at which point you get 200,000 dedicated subscribers on YouTube. The world has changed. But what hasn't changed is that we're fighting for attention, and often that attention we seek has a correlation to other resources. We're not just seeking to be the best at something. We want to be compensated. But the greatest power you can ever have is to be the sun. Anytime you can make resources come to you by way of giving rather than asking or taking, you experience evolutionary ascension. You want the planets to revolve around you in the same way that they do for the sun. It stays the center of attention due to the shine it offers. For instance, I had a personal issue recently that left me inclined to ask someone for help because I didn't want to suffer the fallout from it. But I stopped myself and considered the following. If I ask for something, I'm the vampire. I'm seeking to drain resources from someone else. That makes me a burden. Sometimes that's necessary in life. But other times, if we can find the strength and have the means, we should turn to creation for the answer. I said to myself, if I don't ask for something and instead create my own alternative, I can remain my own sun. I might suffer in the short term, but the things I'll create from the expression of that hardship and burden will be an explosion of light. They will destroy that darkness, aka lack of resources I'm experiencing, and make my star burn brighter. It's the path of most resistance, but also one that leads to the greatest reward. And the reason the process works that way is that it guarantees the greatest extent of creation as a solution to a problem. When you ask for something, you're asking for somebody else's shine as a means of making your sun burn brighter. But when you create, you provide your own resources in a situation where the people you were going to ask to help you will want to do that in the absence of having to ask them. When you create, you have a voice, and if you do it well, that voice is loud and unique to you. The universe wants that. If you do it, it rewards you, and because you aren't relying on someone else to create for you. Your job is to create and have the light, aka warmth, of your sun draw others to its comfort. So, evolution swarming to you for the purpose of ascension is a wonderful thing. But you must create. If you don't, someone else has to create those resources for you. And if someone else is giving them to you, in the absence of you creating anything, you're not only at the mercy of their will, but you abandon leverage too. That's where Tom Foley found himself in life once his basketball days were over. He got everybody to swarm to him, and from that day on, didn't create any magic. So, he latched onto the residual effects of that stardom and asked somebody else to create in his place while he reaped the rewards. That's fine until something goes wrong. That's when he's going to find himself with no means or leverage. And when that happens, and you haven't created any magic for so long, meaning right back to the second you hit that big shot, that is what you'll try to replicate. That's what I see in this crime. Tom wanted to hit another game-winning shot. It's the only way for him to transcend his emotional issue through physical means. Consider how everything came to him as a residual benefit of hitting that shot. Evolution caused the swarm to flock to his light. But over the years that followed, he simply did not create any magic conducive to receiving anything more than diminishing rewards, aka light, that slowly but surely left him living in darkness. Tom Foley's choices in his adult life put him in a place that offered no autonomy, so when issues later developed between him and Dar, and she was the only one of the two who had been creating in their marriage, he had no leverage or means of escape. Tom wanted out of the marriage, but he also wanted custody of his son and the house. He didn't want to lose anything, except Dar. And given that there was an insurance policy on her life, worth slightly more than $300,000 in 2009, Tom saw the sun peeking through the clouds. That was his only way to escape. He needed to hit another game-winning shot that gave him everything for the asking. Tom tells us this isn't true, that $300,000 wasn't enough to last, especially considering their mortgage. But I see right through this bullshit because the resources acquired by hitting the game-winning shot in that basketball game weren't enough to last either, but that's exactly what he settled for as an adult. One shot changed Tom Foley's life. People swarmed to him and rewarded him. That's the only way he knew how to win. So when it came down to it with Dar, when he'd reached the end of his rope, he took another game-winning shot on that fateful day Dar was murdered. That single shotgun blast gave Tom the house, custody of Heath, and insurance money in a situation where he truly won it all. Meanwhile, Dar, who had worked so hard and created so much, lost everything. So, let's dive into Tom's psychological disposition as we indulge the rest of the story. Is Tom Foley truly a sociopath and killer, as the guilty verdict seemed to indicate in his first trial? Or did new evidence coming to light truly exonerate him? Could the jury have made a mistake when he was tried a second time? Of course. Yet, while I know very little about what goes on in the courtroom, I can say it's almost certain the jury didn't unanimously agree that Tom Foley was entirely innocent. I'm sure they followed instructions and believed there was reasonable doubt. Anyhow, Tom and Dar meet in 1991 and never look back. Tom is described as a friendly, laid-back, and not too ambitious sort of guy, while Dar had an alpha personality and was not only constantly engaging the process of achievement, but also labeled as someone who would tell you what to do by a family member in an interview with Dateline. So, we can see the basis for how this partnership forms. There's an underlying barter, I suppose you could say. Tom knows Dar is going to be difficult in terms of her A personality conflicting with his relaxed nature. But due to that same personality, he also knows she'll take the lead financially and otherwise. He's probably going to be able to indulge the easygoing lifestyle he desires. But there's going to be a price to pay for it. Conversely, and without a doubt, Dar is also going to pay a price. A very steep one by the end of this story. But what we can see is that this relationship accommodates the nature of both of these people. Tom wants somebody else to work and take the lead, while Dar wants to be in control. But here's the unspoken aspect of that agreement that leads to murder. Dar is dominant and works hard, while Tom is submissive and doesn't like to work, which means the relationship to which Dar is agreeing is one that involves her husband having no leverage if he ever decides to leave her. On the opposite side of that spectrum, the same goes for Tom. He knows the rules. Now consider that. Tom doesn't like to work, so if he ever wants to leave Dar, it means he'll lose almost everything, including the house, the benefits of her full income, and custody of their son. So, if he leaves Dar, not only does he have to go back to work, but he also has to sacrifice the items just mentioned. That's a tough pill to swallow for a man who likes to take life easy. It would be a rude wake-up call. Tom adored his son Heath. He loved living at their farmhouse with all that land. But he and Dar were reportedly having issues in their marriage. At least one witness in his first trial testified that Tom told him he was thinking of leaving Dar. The killer in this case took a single shot. In the context of Tom Foley, we have motive, means, and opportunity. He stands to gain what he would have lost by leaving Dar. From the perspective of an outside party being guilty, there was no motive, no physical evidence left behind, and despite the home being ransacked, nothing significant was taken. Dar's purse was out in plain sight, untouched. Okay, so let's go through the events of that day, February 7th, 2009. 10-year-old Heath and his friend Skylar are playing video games at the Foley's home. They're waiting to go to Heath's birthday party, which is being held nearby at a friend's house. Unfortunately, I don't know how or why Heath's party wasn't at his own home. It wasn't a surprise party and wasn't taking place at some kind of kids-themed business, so one would have to wonder if Tom Foley had anything to do with the planning. Is it possible he suggested it to the parents of one of Heath's friends, perhaps under the pretense their home was better suited to hosting? Of course, but I don't know how that transpired. Anyhow, Dar is getting ready to take a shower, and like I mentioned, she's planning to follow them soon after. That's when Tom tells Heath and Skylar to go outside and start the truck. He says he'll be out soon, but doesn't specify why he sent them out ahead of him, or even what he'll be doing in the house as they wait. So, I'm not sure if Tom's truck is near the barn, or even in the barn, or if the boys just decided to run around in the barn prior to getting in the truck, but the two kids do go out and play in the barn at this point. Tom doesn't come out right away, but he isn't gone so long that the boys come back to the house. When he arrives at the truck, he drives the boys to the party. But Dar never shows up. She doesn't even call. Now, Tom and Dar didn't have cell phones at this time, which would have been a bit odd for 2009, but it might be due to the fact they lived in a somewhat rural area. Maybe the reception was bad or even non-existent. Of course, it could have also been a personal choice. It just seems odd, given the fact they have a son who's in school, that they don't have cell phones. Either way, the fact of the matter is this. Tom didn't call the family's home number to try to reach Dar. Instead, Tom gets in his truck and drives back to the house. When he arrives, he finds their back kitchen door is wide open, despite the fact it's February in Michigan. Something has to be wrong. That's when his fears are confirmed. Tom notices a glass pane on that door has been broken, and there's glass all over the floor. It's pretty clear to him that somebody broke in, so he needs to find his wife. Tom enters and searches the ransacked house, finally finding Dar dead in the shower. She was shot once in the head with some type of shotgun. He frantically calls 911 and reports that Dar is dead. And that's the end of the event. Now, there are multiple problems with Tom's retelling of it, so let's examine that in an effort to find clues that are related to his sociopathy. He'll follow his desires rather than sound logic, but the logic gaps become apparent when the event is analyzed. So, Tom arrives for the birthday party, along with Heath and Skylar, and everything seems to be fine. But again, soon enough, it's apparent Dar is absent. If someone was running late to begin with, it's a fairly natural course of action to just assume she's still running late. But as the clock ticks away, and she's still not there, your assumption that nothing is wrong would begin to change. Yet, since you haven't taken any action to confirm there's a problem, there's no reason to behave like one exists. The first course of action would be to learn if there's a problem. Now, which of these options seems more reasonable? P picking up the phone, calling Dar at home, and confirming all is well, along with asking when she'll arrive, or getting in the car, leaving your son's party, and driving home to check on her as your son realizes neither of his parents are around anymore. Like I always say, we're conservative by nature because resources, time, and energy are not limitless. We make the conservative move first and take increasingly proactive and riskier steps thereafter to learn the truth. So, the obvious move here for Tom is to call Dar. But he doesn't do that. The first time there's concern, he drives home to check on her. It's not like he has information to suggest something has happened to her. So, let's examine why he would do that. If Tom calls Dar and gets no answer, others will become concerned. If she still doesn't show up after that, and Tom says he's going to leave to go check on her, somebody might insist upon going with him. The problem with that is twofold. If he's just murdered Dar, then there are multiple aspects of the crime to which he still needs to attend. Heath and Skylar being around before leaving for the party prevented him from taking certain actions, which we'll discuss later. Plus, he wants an opportunity to go back over the staged scene and be sure everything looks right and that he didn't make any mistakes. By saying he's going to check on Dar at the first sign of her tardiness, it ensures no one else will share his level of concern. It's not natural. Therefore, when he says, "I'm going to check on her," there won't be an overreaction like, "Oh, just call the police," or, "I'm going with you just to be safe." Tom knows he needs to do this alone, and his best chance to not draw the empathy of others getting involved is to act prior to when they would. Of course, he's also anxious to get this over with. He wants the treasure that's waiting. So right from the start, Tom has already manipulated the natural course of events twice. First, he told the kids to go out and start up the truck, offering no explanation as to why they needed to go ahead of him and be outside of the house during this time. They were playing video games. It's Heath's birthday. What was wrong with that? Why send him and Skylar out to the barn in February, away from the house, and tell them to start up the truck? The kids later say they don't know what Tom was doing during that time in which they were sent outside. Normally, if kids were wired and making a lot of noise or running around inside, and you were still getting ready, you might send them outside to play and let off that steam. But these two are just playing video games and are told to leave the house for reasons they can't really understand, except to start the truck. Why would they need to do that? Tom plays it off like it was a perfectly normal thing to do, just like he does with his assertion that driving home to see if Dar was okay wasn't odd. But what he can't see is that both of these actions support the endeavor to create windows of time in which A, the murder can be committed, and B, the staging can take place. We're soon going to learn there's evidence he might have killed Dar when he sent the boys outside, and the crime scene suggests he finished staging the break-in when he hastily returned from the birthday party instead of trying to call Dar first. Neither of these choices is backed by sound logic, and, not coincidentally, we learn the nature and timing of these events lend themselves to Tom being guilty. There was no reason to send the kids out into the cold. I have no doubt they were perfectly happy playing video games on a winter day. And there was no reason to drive home to see if Dar was okay prior to calling her. If you recall the episode I did on David Bain, you have a similar circumstance here, in the sense that the suspect's logic was not organic. Reordered logic is redirection of light, and more specifically, physical manipulation of circumstances. That's what sociopaths do. Anyhow, Tom drives home and learns Dar's vehicle is still there. He goes to the back kitchen door, which is the one they enter after parking at the farm, and sees the pane of glass smashed out of the door closer to the handle. It's quite typical of what someone would do to break in. The door is also wide open. Now, one could easily infer, along with the info that Dar hasn't arrived at the party, that something criminal has taken place, and that Dar is either hurt, dead, or has been kidnapped. Clearly an intruder has entered the house. That means there's danger. Tom doesn't know if the intruder is there, or if it's perhaps more than one person. It could be a home invasion involving multiple people. Now, again, in terms of the order of the logic, what is the first thing you'd do if you walked up to that open back door, saw the glass smashed out, and knew your wife's car was still there? You'd call her name. There's no noise in the house at that time. It's quiet. Tom doesn't walk in on a burglary, or a robbery, or even Dar getting assaulted. The place is silent. So the reason we call out for people first, when we think something is wrong, but can't see them, is for the simple fact we desire an answer about their well-being as soon as possible, in addition to allowing ourselves the greatest chance of survival if there is danger. In the absence of being in their presence, we try to learn as much as possible. Again, it also acts as a survival mechanism. If Tom calls out for Dar and hears her moaning or begging for help, not only does it reveal her location, but it also means someone or something has caused her harm, given the break-in. There could still be danger lurking, and if you don't heed that warning, you might be of no use to her and could even fall victim yourself. It doesn't even have to be in relation to a murderer. There could have been an accident. I'll give you a great example of why this is important. When I was a kid, my neighbor's husband, who was a cop, was driving through a rainstorm one night in the local area and saw a boy face down in the stream of water running along the curb toward the gutter. He stopped his patrol car, got out, and called out to the boy as he ran over to assist. Obviously, with the boy being face down in water, there was no response, and therefore, no way to know what happened. So this cop runs over to the kid, and as soon as he steps in the water, he gets lit up like a Christmas tree from a downed power line he didn't see and drops dead. Of course, the boy suffered the same fate and wasn't able to help save the guy. Now, here's the thing. The cop didn't have the privilege of learning about the danger prior to entering it because he couldn't see the downed power line and the boy couldn't respond. Sometimes that happens. It's life. You do something courageous and selfless that costs you, like dragging someone from a burning car, only to have it explode during the process. But either way, you do what you can to assess the danger prior to entering the situation. The rescuer knows the car could blow up because he sees the fire burning, and the cop knows there could be unseen danger that caused the boy to drop dead, but they still assess the situation the best they can. The cop still calls out to the boy. The rescuer acts despite the car being on the verge of exploding. An attempt at assessment occurs. But here's Tom at the back door. He sees the smashed glass. The door is open. Yet he doesn't call out for Dar. Doing so could also get an intruder to panic or move to try to hide or even come to the door to attack Tom. Beyond that, the first thing you want to establish is if Dar is okay. That's the point of coming home. So Tom sees the danger but makes no assessment. Unlike the cop who called out for the boy, or the rescuer who knows what could happen running into the burning car, Tom decides the best thing to do is to proceed in complete ignorance of the danger. He tells us he searched the house and finally found her, but not once does he make any suggestion that he was apprehensive, scared, or otherwise affected. If someone broke into your house and blasted your wife in the face with a shotgun, the implication is that someone wanted to kill her, and if that person is still there, they certainly aren't going to leave Tom as a witness. They're going to kill him too. At the very least, he would have called out for her. Danger was obviously present. But he doesn't. Now, notice this as well. Tom's decision to leave the party, instead of calling, fits the logic of something terrible having happened to Dar. But he shouldn't have known that or even suspected it. Yet he's the person who's employing this logic when no one else is. He's behaving as though something bad has happened when there's no reason to believe that. And then, when he gets home, he's acting as though there's no danger present. So if he's acting like something terrible happened to Dar, and isn't worried he's in danger as well, that disposition suggests that he killed her. He knows something terrible happened, and also knows he can go home and enter the house, despite an apparent break-in, because there's nobody there to kill him. Now, Tom calls 911, and like so many of these sociopaths, decides to reorder the emotional process to accommodate the situation. Shock is supposed to precede grief, but when Tom makes the 911 call, he's already wailing in agony and crying that Dar is gone. Most genuine 911 calls I've ever heard don't consist mostly of the caller expressing grief. Instead, the caller is normally in a state of shock. Many people stay perfectly calm during 911 calls, even kids, and even while there's a violent crime transpiring, due to the presence of shock. Tom finds a family member dead in the bathtub. That happened to me, too. I did not cry on the phone during the 911 call. The thought of grieving or crying in any way was far from my mind. I was shocked. But the sociopath only thinks about their desires rather than sound logic. So in the same way Tom just wants to rush home and find Dar, instead of calling her and making the process more organic, skipping that step, he does the same here. He's looking for a shortcut to a place where he can express how hurt he is by Dar's death. His perceived innocence takes precedence. Feigning shock won't make you look innocent, but pretending to be emotionally crushed will convince some people you're telling the truth. Yet, Tom has been reordering the logic of his actions and reactions since the moment he told the boys to go start up the truck. So, the police arrive, and within 24 hours, the lead detective is sure Tom Foley was the perpetrator. But in the meantime, this is what they see. The home has been lightly ransacked, with the intruder taking financial documents, a few credit cards, and rifling through the couple's medicine cabinet in the bathroom. But there are all sorts of expensive electronics left behind, in addition to Dar's purse. Now, consider this. Where do you think Dar's credit cards would be located? In her purse, probably, right? Nobody took anything from it, despite the fact it was sitting on a chair in the hallway, right out in the open. That means any cash in there remained in the purse. So at the end of the day, how much money did Tom lose? None at all. The credit cards that were missing from the home could be easily replaced. Who gives a shit about financial documents? How does that help the killer? It doesn't. This has been referred to as a robbery gone wrong. But I'm curious what went wrong. Dar was murdered in the shower. If she was still in the shower when she got killed, then clearly she didn't know anything was amiss. It was just a murder. This was a hit. So what's the motive? You have a nude, unsuspecting woman alone in her house, made ignorant of an attacker by the running water in the shower, and there's no attempt at sexual assault. There's only an assassination. But who would want her dead? There are very few homicides in that region, and she wasn't even involved in an affair that could have caused a jealous spouse to act. There's no available motive outside of a random intruder killing her and gaining nothing by it. Unless, of course, you also consider an insurance payout of $300,000 that Tom would receive in the event of her death. Tom Foley is the person who stood to gain the most by killing his wife. It's clear that nothing taken from the home during the robbery was detrimental to his financial situation. The only significant thing missing from the home was Dar. Now, to support that assertion, this crime happens right after a heavy snowmelt. The temperature rose above freezing with a lot of snow on the ground, leaving the yard outside the farmhouse wet and muddy. Yet, law enforcement finds no trace of an intruder inside the home. They can't detect so much as one foreign shoe print either inside the home or outside. The intruder or intruders would have had to walk across the wet, muddy grass to get to the back door to break in. But there's nothing. So, if Tom Foley was the only person who gained by this crime, and there's no evidence anyone else entered the home, or was even outside it, we see the truth. The ransacking and theft truly amounts to nothing lost. But with one shot, one perfectly aimed shot to Dar's head, Tom wins it all. He gets the house, more than $300,000, custody of his son, freedom to be with other women, and anything else, including release from her control. As soon as the trigger is pulled, a circumstance arises in which evolution is going to swarm him. But what he doesn't realize, meaning the tragedy here, is that evolution is definitely going to swarm to him again, but in a negative way. This isn't the winning basket in the big game. It's crime. The rules are different. With success, or creation, evolution swarms to feel the shine of your light, as the sun. In crime, it tries to correct the corrupted pathway of redirected light in order to seek truth, in addition to forging advanced technology related to detection. The reason it does so is because society will crumble if people like Tom Foley are regularly allowed to murder their spouses and get paid for it. They won't create. So, we see his redirected light through detection methods as simple as the human eye. There's no physical evidence an intruder entered the Foley home or even walked around outside. Nothing equating to substantial material loss was taken during the crime. Tom had no reason to leave the party before trying to call Dar. There wasn't sound logic utilized in calling out for Dar upon seeing the break-in and entering the home. Tom never offered the boys a reason for why they were sent outside to start the truck. He never told them what his intentions were during that time. And he leapfrogs the shock stage because he's desperate to prove he's destroyed by Dar's death. In fact, if there's anything about this case that really resonates with me, it's the fact that Heath, the Foley son, will later admit to his father Tom that he believes the man killed his mother. Tom asks why he thinks that, and Heath simply responds, "Who else could have done it?" Now, not only do the police find no evidence anybody entered the home, but in the basement, they discover a yellow plastic bag with black writing on it from a retail store. They bring this bag to the attention of Tom Foley, suggesting that all the items around it were dusty, as could be expected in a basement, but this bag was not. Inside the bag, they found 3 shotgun shells, and on the outside of the bag, they find a fingerprint that belongs to Tom. Yet, he says he's never seen it before. Tom goes on to say that they had other bags in the house from that same business, insinuating the intruder could have hidden the shells in the basement after the murder using one of their bags. He argues that he has never owned a shotgun and wouldn't know how to operate it if he did. But here's the problem. Nobody else's fingerprints are on the bag, and there just isn't a reason for an outside party to put it down there. So we have a bag with Tom's fingerprint on it, containing multiple shotgun shells, and no evidence an intruder entered their home. The fact that he walked in without calling out for Dar, in my mind, is equally suspicious. But here's where it gets ugly. Detectives are going to have to question Heath and Skylar. Of course, at 10 years old, we don't know what we'll get from them. But Skylar drops a bombshell. He says that when the boys went out to the barn and were told to start up the truck, that he heard a loud crashing sound from the rear of the house. Heath later confirms he heard the same thing when confronted about the possibility. But what is this crash Skylar's talking about? If the break-in was at the glass on the back door, it would make sense for that to be the noise he heard. But Tom was still inside and left through that door, so it couldn't have happened right then. That's when detectives show Skylar a map that depicts the layout of the property, and they ask him to point to the place where he thinks the sound originated. He promptly puts a finger at the back of the house, right outside the first floor bathroom window. Of course, not only is that the bathroom in which Dar is murdered, but this crash comes at a time when only one person is in the house aside from Dar, Tom Foley. Skyler says he thought the sound was a gunshot, and when asked about it 2 years after the fact, in relation to Tom's retrial, Skyler says his opinion was entirely solidified in the time between the incident and when he was most recently asked, because he had attended a church function of some kind, a camp, where he learned to shoot a shotgun. As soon as he heard the blasts up close, he was sure that was exactly what he had heard the day of Dar's murder. Heath, on the other hand, will eventually admit he heard a crashing sound like Skyler did, and that he thought it was one of two things. Either Skyler running into a wall in the barn while they were playing before the party, when Tom sent them outside, or, if not that, he believed it was a gunshot. Obviously, this is a very difficult line of questioning for a kid who just lost his mother due to this incident, and could have lost his father too, in a situation where the man was not only a murderer, but went to prison. In that light, Tom says he thinks Heath's statement was encouraged by Dar's family, that he had been poisoned by their suggestions. But even if we set aside Heath's assertions, Skyler identified the sound as a gunshot and pointed specifically to the place on the house where it occurred. Now, we could ask ourselves if it's possible Tom broke the glass at that time, and that's what they heard, but I'm certain he did that upon returning. The shotgun blast was indoors, muffling it, but the police said it seemed a beer bottle was used to smash out the window and back. But of course, the person was breaking in from the outside, so that sound is going to be very loud behind the house. I don't think Tom could have risked being seen doing that, especially given how loud it would be. If he shoots inside, obviously it's still loud, but he can't be seen. Anyway, if the boys heard it and looked, how on earth would he explain that he just smashed out a pane of glass on the back door? Still, he has to explain that loud noise Skyler believed was a gunshot. And he tells us that what he was doing at the time was moving some old window frames from the barn that contained glass. He claims he dropped one, and it broke as it crashed to the ground. Tom says it's the noise Skyler would have heard. Now, Dar's sisters, in that same Dateline interview I mentioned, suggested that they always thought there was something wrong with Tom. And for what reason? Because he was with Dar. They truly had no idea how a man could tolerate her. She had an A-type personality, was demanding and controlling, and in their words, she wasn't, quote, domesticated. It's easy to see how Tom had no leverage. A neighbor suggested Tom would never do this to his son, but I think what she's missing is the fact that a sociopath couldn't give a shit about what others think. He does what's best for him, without concern for those he loves getting in the way. I mean, just consider the fact that he killed Dar with a shotgun blast to the head, instead of divorcing her, and did it on the day of their son's 10th birthday. It's all about getting what he desires. The sociopath can love and cherish others every second of every day, but only as long as he's getting what he wants. When a situation arises in which he can no longer get what he wants, at that point, anything goes. For the sociopath, the lie becomes the truth. He doesn't feel he's hiding anything. And that's why they get so sloppy in the process. They think others don't see it. But the police did when they found the bag of shells. Skyler and Heath did when they heard the shotgun blast. And the party guests knew it when he drove home. Sociopaths redirect light with the intention of crafting the truth, but it's manipulation. We can craft truth and fiction through emotional authenticity. We're being honest, but if you write that same story with a dishonest narrative, it amounts to lies. The audience watching a film knows this and will realize what you've done, causing them to turn against you and say, wow, this movie really sucks. That character wouldn't do that. In a murder case, detectives become the audience. In the same way you expect the stories in your entertainment to enlighten you through a truth that says, life is like that, detectives also want that narrative. So, I think there's enough to put Tom Foley behind bars. And the jury agrees. But the day after he's convicted, literally the next day, a woman comes forward with information she saw a white car speeding out of the driveway at the Foley's house the afternoon Dar was murdered. She claims the driver was 18 to 20 years old, a white male, and basically appeared to be crazy or out of control. According to her story, his car almost hit hers, and she thought the kid was going to end up killing someone. She came forward, like I said, right after the conviction, and said she hadn't before because she was scared. But once Tom was convicted, she knew she needed to act to set him free. The next person, meaning the second witness, claimed to have seen a black SUV leaving the home that same afternoon. And there was supposedly another witness claiming a different vehicle. For me, the fact that the vehicles are all inconsistent says that they're lying. Tom Foley was still well-liked in the community, and people knew who he was. They wanted to help him out. Notice all three parties clearly only came forward once Tom got convicted, not before. But this type of evidence gets him a retrial, among other considerations. And one of those is that his attorneys visit his home and discover a shard of glass in the area where he says he dropped the barn window. It fits the frames from the barn windows, seemingly suggesting that Tom was telling the truth, and thereby explaining the loud crash Skylar and Heath heard. On a side note, that's another sociopathic byproduct right there. How in the world did Tom think the kids wouldn't hear the shotgun blast? There was only a window between the blast and the kids by the barn. The answer is that he wanted this so much, he had to do it the only way he could. This plot might have worked if he had chosen a different method of murder that neglected to make a huge booming sound. But the basis for everything he did was getting rid of the shotgun and not having ever owned one so that he would seem innocent. He said he wouldn't even know how to operate a shotgun, so it's possible he had no idea what would happen when he pulled the trigger indoors near a window. But again, I think he was really that desperate. He was just going to push ahead. Because Tom had no way out. If he left Dar, he would have to rebuild. And since he hadn't done much of the building in his marriage with Dar, he would have to go back to square one. I think it was too daunting. It's what he should have done. Instead, we get this. Tom physically extracts Dar from the equation because he's emotionally incapable of starting over on his own. He wants the $300K, custody of his son, and the house. But most of all, I think he just soured on Dar's personality over the years, in the absence of having any leverage. He desperately wanted freedom from it, and in the worst way. And with their son being 10 years old, I think change was on the horizon in the household in terms of Dar's expectations for him. Heath was already past those years in which he required constant care, and that burden would lessen as time went on. Dar, who kept a very busy schedule, would likely expect Tom to do something with himself as Heath grew. Clearly, he had no intention of that. He wasn't going to leave her. He was going to kill her. The sociopath inverts the emotional issue inside him to make it the physical problem of someone extraneous to him in the pursuit of acquiring resources. The thing Tom lacked in the marriage was control. When you win a championship, it's often referred to as winning it all. And Tom did that, like I said earlier, with a single shot for his high school basketball team. He didn't have another strategy to rely on. And you can see hidden within that action that he hadn't felt like a winner since that time. Emotionally, he needed to take that shot again, to risk missing the mark in the pursuit of glory, but this time with the stakes being much higher. And he hit that shot, but he fouled a lot of people, primarily Dar and his son, on his way to the basket. When you take the final shot in a big game, like he did, with everything on the line, you'll be remembered as the person who won or lost the game, and live with the glory or scorn in the aftermath. That's what Tom Foley did. And the new evidence after the first trial had the referees gathering to discuss the foul and whether it's the right call. They had to confer. Now, the second time around, the jury hears from the defense about a new narrative in which possibly all three of the vehicles witnessed at the Foley's home were involved in the crime. And that testimony, along with the shard of glass, seems to be enough to raise reasonable doubt in the minds of the jurors. But now that the shard of glass has been introduced, it could backfire if anyone knows how it truly originated. And that happens. Dar's niece testifies that a week before the murder, when she was babysitting there, she was told to stay away from the back porch area because Tom dropped one of the barn window frames. The judge ruled it was hearsay, and the jury was never privileged to hearing that. So, Tom Foley is set free. And with that, custody of his son Heath is returned to him. So what do I think really happened? I'd say the toughest part of answering that question is to consider where Tom got the shotgun in the first place, without anybody ratting on him later, and also how he disposed of the thing without a trace. He might have acquired it illegally. He might have stolen it from someone nearby. We just don't know without any evidence. And that's another reason for doubt. But the shotgun shells in the basement really say something specific to me. In the chaos of orchestrating the events of that day, Tom simply forgot about the bag of shells. Now, in terms of the timeline, I think Tom sent the boys outside, at which point Dar got in the shower. That left Tom free to go get the shotgun, which I believe was likely hidden in the basement along with the shells. He goes back to the first floor, enters the bathroom where Dar's showering, puts the barrel of the shotgun into the shower, behind the curtain, shielding himself from blood, and shoots her. It's hard to say if he covered himself otherwise, or if perhaps he changed clothes first and disposed of the clothes later. We know he was inside for a little while before coming out to take the kids to the party. But I think this is when Tom makes preparations to dispose of the shotgun and also stages the ransacking of the home. And that's another reason I think he wanted to drive home from the party without even calling. I think the murder weapon was still there. Anyhow, they go to the party, and as mentioned, Tom ends up leaving to drive home instead of calling. He claims if he and Dar had cell phones, he would have called her, but they didn't. Well, they had a home phone, and clearly somebody at the party, like the homeowner, would have a phone you could use to make a local call. It's not like you're dialing internationally to talk for 3 hours. In what way does having a cell phone change anything? He didn't call. It's that simple. It's because he needed to get back there and finish the job alone. He couldn't risk anybody else getting there first, not even by accident. So I think he drives home, breaks the kitchen back door glass, checks everything to be sure he didn't forget the details, and disposes of the shotgun nearby with related items in the event his clothes were bloody or he shielded himself with an object, anything like that. I think he had a place on his farm, or at least nearby, to hide the shotgun, somewhere that would suffice in fooling the cops as to its whereabouts. But in the process of all of this, he forgets the bag of shells. It's no different than walking out the door for vacation, or even work, and forgetting your toothbrush or your lunch. When you're in a hurry, anxious, and under pressure, you sometimes forget things. I think that's what happened to Tom. Could the bag of shells have been planted to make him look bad? Sure, but only his fingerprint is on it. And of course, it's hard to discount both kids testifying that they heard a gunshot, along with the fact we can't substantiate the presence of another person being in the house, even by way of shoe prints coming in from soggy, muddy grass outside. So, in my opinion, Tom Foley committed this crime. But the answer as to where he got the shotgun and how he disposed of it raised doubts about that assertion. In the end, however, Heath and Skyler claiming they heard that gunshot seals it for me. Not for a second do I think those kids wanted to get Tom in trouble, especially his son. Heath waited until the second time he was interviewed to suggest he heard a gunshot, but you have to imagine he's really scared to hurt his dad and lose him too. Losing his mother had to be tragic enough. Likewise, Skyler is his friend. They don't want to be saddled with this adult responsibility at age 10 or 12. But they were. And I think they were telling the truth. I believe the noise they heard was the shotgun blast that killed Dar Foley. But let's consider that for a moment. Heath heard that noise and later learned what it was. Could there be anything so awful as learning that the reason your mom didn't show up to your 10th birthday party was because your father had murdered her? Try to imagine if somebody did that to you. I mean, I know father and son were reunited after the second trial, but at what cost? Heath made it explicitly clear to Tom that he thinks Tom killed Dar. And that's the person he went back to live with after the not guilty verdict. How do you reconcile something like that, especially when you're just a little kid, and then you have to grow up to have your thoughts solidify what the truth actually is? Sadly, I think the answer is that you don't. You don't reconcile those things. Undoubtedly, the day of the birthday party, which should have been a great memory for him to carry into his adulthood, became the day the facade came crashing down. His father was a bad man. His mother was dead. I mean, Tom chose to pull this stunt on Heath's birthday because the scenario seemed to work well. He never thought about his son, not even for a moment. In the end, everything people believed about Tom Foley was a lie. Or was it? You decide. But in closing this out, I just want to talk about who we are for a minute. By that, I mean that we have these lives where we're forced to trust the people around us, whether it's the guy walking to his car behind you, your spouse, or even your neighbor. We have this social contract that strongly urges us to offer civility, decency, and above all else, empathy for those around us, so that, in return, we can all feel at least somewhat safe and live peaceful, meaningful existences. Of course, there are many disruptions to that, and so we lock our doors at night in our houses, install alarms on our cars, and sometimes we own weapons too. We want to keep the bad people out. We want to prevent losing the things we love to outsiders. For that reason, we extend our trust to those we know best. Our homes are locked at night, knowing the people we love are safe inside, and that no one can get them. But the tragedy born of that disposition is that, in order to extend our trust, we must also be willing to experience betrayal. Sometimes the bad guy sleeps next to us, and we never realize it until it's too late. Dar Foley didn't realize that was Tom, and he betrayed her. He also betrayed their son. But in the process, what was gained by Tom from a material standpoint in the killing of Dar could never be worth what was lost emotionally for Heath. This boy lost his mother, and that mother never saw tomorrow. It can all be taken from us in a flash, even at the hands of those we love most and who claim to feel the same way. People can turn their backs on us at any moment, and we can do the same to them. So I ask myself, why do we do it? How can we all still trust each other? And I think the answer is because we have to. In reality, the only thing that's worse than being betrayed is feeling alone. To have never loved is a tragedy far worse than having been betrayed. Our willingness to trust equates to our ability to love. In that light, I think the only way to live is on the edge of a high cliff from which you could fall at any moment. The trust you extend is the love you receive. So when we leave each other today, and you go back out onto the court of life, finding the ball in your hands because the team trusts you to take the game-winning shot, don't hesitate for a moment. They're giving you the ball because they can see your light shining and believe in you to take them where they're going. Sometimes you lose, but if you always take the shot, you never fail. People put their trust in you, and you in them, because they want you to lead them somewhere, and desire to do the same for you. So, never be afraid to take the shot. Never fear losing. Do that, and never look back.